there, who are you listeners? Before we get going with Paleo FX co-founder Keith Norris, I wanted to tell you a little bit about why you're not hearing Craig Dinkle. My name is Trey Elling. I've been in broadcasting, and more specifically radio, for more than 20 years now. Currently, I host Middays on 104.9 The Horn in Austin, Texas. I love my job, especially having conversations with fascinating people. Craig and I spoke recently. Craig loves the podcast. I asked him for a chance. Here we are. As previously mentioned, my guest today is Keith Norris. Keith is the co-founder of Paleo FX. In a short amount of time, Keith and his wife Michelle have turned the Austin-based Paleo FX into the world's premier holistic wellness event, whose focus includes health, nutrition, fitness, and self-development. But there's a whole lot more to Keith's story. Keith and I talked about the evolution of Paleo FX, how a childhood encounter with Arnold Schwarzenegger at a San Antonio mall helped stoke his lifelong love for fitness, why he traded food for translated East German workout plans while serving in the Navy in the mid-1980s, what allowed he and his wife to get through every parent's worst nightmare, the loss of a child, and more.
So I was serving right at the time when the wall came down, which is interesting because I can remember being in West Berlin, and I think we might have talked about this at another time, but somewhere there's a blackmail picture of me looking very Tom Cruise, wearing a blue Levi's jacket, drinking a beer in West Berlin, and flipping off the guard at Checkpoint Charlie.
What is your favorite resistance training exercise right now, Keith?
Man, I love deadlifts. You cannot get away from deadlifts, trap bar deadlifts to be specific.
That's one of my favorite exercises right now, too. I feel like I got into it in the last couple of months hearing about it on a podcast. And I got to say, the grip of the straight bar deadlift, it never struck me as right. But to be able to put your arms down to the side like that and to be able to push through what is right. Essentially the trap bar is something that has been very beneficial.
Right. It's a fantastic exercise. In fact, when I was training collegiate athletes, football players, we never straight bar deadlift. I always had them in the trap bar. There's no inherent benefit to doing a straight bar deadlift. It's just, you know, we generally have barbells around, and it's the right tool. It's a good tool, but we're always looking to perfect those tools.
Absolutely. Is there an exercise that you see as just an utter waste of anybody's time who tries to go through it?
You know, I spend a lot of time at a Globo gym here lately, which I have not been in like, I don't know, 25 years. I have not had to be in a Globo gym, but just circumstances have come about. We've moved. I've gotten out of the gym business of actually owning gyms, which puts me back in a Globo gym a lot of times. And I don't even know where I can begin with exercises that somebody should not do. We could spend a whole podcast talking about gym failures.
It's a little bit of a loaded question. It usually starts. You can take a good exercise and turn it into a bad one based on the fact that the individual who's doing it either has poor form or just generally has no clue of what it is that they're doing.
Right. And I always used to say there are no bad exercises. There's bad application.
That's a good way
to
put it.
And I would always tell my trainers, I'm like, I don't care what the exercise is. But if I walk up to you and ask, why are you using this particular exercise with this client, you should be able to tell me immediately why you're using it. And I think trainees should ask themselves that every time too. And I still do this, and I've been training 40 plus years. I still ask myself, why this exercise, why this load scheme, why this set and rep scheme, and why in this place in my workout am I doing it? Because if you just go willy-nilly, you know, you're never going to – a dog that chases two rabbits catches none. That's kind of the idea.
Functional exercise is one of those ideas, one of those terms that seems to have really surfaced in the last 3 to 4 years. And although it is maybe being used to the point that it started to become cliche, right. If you're applying it correctly, it's something that is very beneficial to everyone.
Right, right. And, that was a backlash from the 70s and 80s bodybuilding gym culture, right? Because they did a lot of isolation movements, and they did a lot of these movements because that was their sport. And if you're going to be involved in bodybuilding, you have to spend a lot of time on isolation-type exercises. That's just the nature of the game. But where we went off the rails was thinking that would work with athletes. and it doesn't. You have to, with an athlete, you have to do, and I'm using air quotes, it didn't translate well in podcast situation, but you have to come back to the more functional movements, right? Sure. You have to squat, you have to deadlift, you have to, you know, I prefer dips over a flat bench, but that's this my, in that, again, I would always tell my athletes, look, if you're having to bench press during, in that, football is what I coach. So if you're having to bench press during a football game, something's wrong, right? That means you're flat on your back. Something's wrong.
For an exercise.
Just being facetious, right? But still, offensive linemen and defensive linemen still have to use their hands quite a bit, right? And so that punching motion, you can still get benefit out of a bench press. But yeah, for most people, I like a dip versus a bench press.
And for an exercise as popular as bench press is too, I mean, it's one of the main factors that they're measuring at the NFL Combine each and every year. You're right. When you're applying that on the field, and also for individuals who are just doing it like, you know, gym junkies like myself or you, there are plenty of other better exercises that you can use to build up the muscles that you're working on, whether it's the pecs, whether it's the triceps as well. But it is just that ingrained in our gym culture now that it's an exercise pretty much everybody does.
It is gym culture. And not only is a bench press used in the combine, but it's also a high rep bench press. These guys are doing 225, which for them is nothing. And so you see these reps of like 40 reps, 45 reps, which is nothing for them. And why? What is that measuring? What can somebody, if I get the report, the combine report, and I look at, I wouldn't even consider the bench press. What would I consider? The 40 for sure. I would look at that, and I would look at vertical jump and broad jump. Those are the two big, vertical jump and broad jump, you can tell a lot about an athlete from just those two motions.
Well, I appreciate you joining me in studio today because Paleo FX 2019 is fast approaching now. It's April 26th through 28th, of course, here in Austin at the Palmer Event Center. It's a great venue to host an expo like this. This is far from the first year that you guys are hosting this expo. It's one of the most popular health and wellness events on the planet at this point. Just where are you now in terms of the nerves and the preparedness as you embark on another version of Paleo FX?
So, Trey, as I sit here across from you and you just mentioned the dates, my stomach dropped. Because I'm like, oh, wow, we are so close. And when we hit January of every year, it is like somebody uncorks a bottle. It just takes off the amount of work we have to do. Our team kind of comes out of this mini hibernation, and they are on go. It is 24/7, and it is ramping up quickly. That's why I have that look that I have in my eye right now, because it is go time for us.
You guys have been very successful at expanding this. When you and I met a couple days ago, I don't know what the reason is. Maybe it is with how popular and how big this event has become in a relatively short amount of time. I just assumed that the event itself was 10 years old, but it's not. You guys have been doing this since 2012. It started out as an event that was on the University of Texas campus, and the next year you moved it to the Palmer Event Center. What do you credit with the reason for its great and its quick success like what we've seen?
Well, we are only a mirror and a platform for the paleo movement as a whole. So as the paleo movement as a whole takes off, we take off. And this movement, because people see results from following the diet and the lifestyle, and they tell their friends, and their friends tell their friends. I mean, it is the epitome of a grassroots movement right now. And we are the beneficiaries of that word spreading. And it's just a good time. I mean, people think, you know, how exciting can a quote-unquote diet and academic conference be? It is a blast, because lifestyle is also part of the paleo movement. Tribe, connectedness, spirituality, relationships, finances, philosophy, psychology, all of these are elements of an optimized human being, and we study all of those under the paleo umbrella. And diet, yes, is important. And life or exercise is important, of course. But all of these other elements come into play, too. So you have this very diverse mix of expertise that comes together under one roof, all of which are looking to better the human organism. And so it becomes this super, you know, the super hive of just great ideas. And the people there are just expressive and vibrant and alive. I mean, it is so different to go to Walmart, say, and walk through Walmart and then come to a PaleoFX event and walk through that event. It's totally different. And at the same time, it is a bit depressing because you know this is only a small fraction of the population, right? That this, the diseases of modernity have spread so far and so deep throughout our culture and throughout the world, you know, that it's really pushing us on the verge of financial collapse. And we're collapsing under the pressure of ill health right now.
That is true. And while a lot of the elements that you're listing off seem so obvious now, back in 2011 and a little bit before that, as you and your wife were really starting to conceive this idea and then putting it into action in 2012, those things weren't so obvious. So how did you realize that this was missing from the market? And how did you describe it to industry insiders in a way to get them to participate from the beginning?
Right. I wish I could sit here and tell you that I had a grand plan going into this, but did not, not at all. Hmm. We just happened to know everybody within this sphere. We had very, very good connections to all of the people, all the Rob Wolfs, all the Mark Sissons, all the Ben Greenfields, you know, all of these people who are now leaders in the paleo movement. We just knew them. They were good friends of ours. And we like to hang out with them. And we thought, we have been to business masterminds before where the nature of a business mastermind is you go in and you're able to connect and rub shoulders with people who may be outside of your area of expertise, and hopefully they are, but you get to trade ideas, right? There's this mixing of ideas that come about. And we thought, you know, why don't we do this in the paleo community? This would be kind of a cool thing to do. And without any business plan whatsoever. And in fact, it was a back of the napkin idea on a plane flight from LA back to Austin that we kind of wrote out a general plan of what an event would look like. And we were just crazy enough to actually see it through and actually take that piece of paper and do something with it.
How close was the first year in 2012 to the plan that had been written down on the napkin?
It was close.
Okay.
What's funny is our idea of what this first of all, that first event, although it was a fundamental success, it was a financial train wreck.
Which is usually the case with new ideas, at least the first couple of years.
Right, and especially with events, and especially with an event, and we thought we were so smart. We did it right in the middle of South by Southwest because we thought, hey, it's great. There'd be a bunch of people in town anyway for South by Southwest. They probably, if they're interested in paleo, they probably want to just kind of drift by this event and check it out, which was the worst financial mistake we could have ever, ever made. Try to find one piece of audiovisual equipment in Austin during South by Southwest.
Oh, true.
Which we didn't think about. Try to find a hotel room. Try to find a transport van.
Oh my gosh.
It was a nightmare. I remember calling Avis and, you know, calling around just trying to get a 15-person transport van and them laughing at me. Do you realize what's going on in your town right now? And we had to drive to San Antonio to get a van. I mean, it was just craziness. So yeah, we got drugged behind the truck a little bit. We learned our lesson. We actually did year two to dig us out of the financial straits that we had created in year one.
But you had made enough corrections that it made up for the difference?
Right, yeah. So we had, and this wasn't our only business at the time. I owned gyms and I was a trainer here in Austin. Mm-hmm. Michelle ran a catering company. She was a chef. And so really this PaleoFX thing we did was just we're entrepreneurs, and that's what entrepreneurs do. You have a good idea, you think it might work, you throw it against the wall, see if it sticks. And we did that. And we, you know, as we got into it, we're like, oh, we're having to stroke some pretty heavy checks here to keep this thing afloat. But it looks like it's going to be a success. So let's back up. Let's try to build a business plan around this, and let's roll out year two and see what we can do with it.
Oh, so you saw the potential for success even in year one as you were dealing with all sorts of craziness.
Even though it was a financial failure, we saw the fundamental success it could be.
Okay.
We did see that. And which is crazy because the first year we had 12 exhibitors on our exhibitor floor because there were no paleo foods out at that time. You know, and there were just a couple of what you would consider now to be biohacking companies or devices. And so we just didn't have a whole lot to choose from. And even from the first year, we wanted this to be a well-curated show. We didn't want just anybody to be able to show up on the PaleoFX floor and be able to you know, show their wares. So, you know, that was one good thing we went into from year one was whoever is on our floor as an exhibitor is going to have to pass a, you know, a pretty good litmus test. And last year we had 140 something exhibitors, and this year we'll have probably around 160. So the movement has grown exponentially.
I want to delve back into the litmus test in a little bit, but I also want to get a little bit of your background, Keith. When did you first find yourself interested in health and wellness?
When I came out of the womb. So I was, you know, I was that kid that was just the hyperactive kid, right? I've always been this kinetic motion being. And I always just gravitated towards things that were physical. I was a climber. I was a runner. You know, I just, you couldn't get me inside and get me to sit still, which caused some problems in school. I remember the summer of 76. I was, how old was I? 11 years old. I remember I saw the first Rocky movie, summer of 76. I saw Bruce Jenner, back when it was Bruce Jenner, win the gold medal decathlon at that time. And I also saw Pumping Iron, Arnold Schwarzenegger in Pumping Iron. Those three things happened. I also happened to meet Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was doing a sporting goods store in San Antonio, was doing a grand opening.
Wow.
And this was when nobody knew who the hell Arnold Schwarzenegger was.
Barely spoke English at that time.
Right, barely spoke English. And he had done, I think, like Stay Hungry and maybe one other movie at that time. This is way before the Conan stuff, right? So no one knew who he was. I knew who he was. And I remember begging my dad to take me down there to see him at this opening. And, you know, my dad was like, who? And, you know, whatever. Okay, so he took me. There might have been 15 people there. Nobody knew who he was. But I remember just being so awestruck at, number one, how big he was. I mean, and I come from a family of big people. I have uncles that are big. I come from a football family. I'm used to seeing big and athletic. Biggest human being I'd ever seen at that time. But the other thing about it that I saw at this age, and this is just about when testosterone's starting to kick in, I could tell that there was a lot of ladies there that were checking him out. A lot. And I thought, I have zero musical talent. I don't have, you know, I'm not the smartest tool in the shed, but I think I can do that. I think I can be an athlete. But yeah, and the other thing about that was he actually sat down and talked to me for a while. Right. I'm like this 11, 12-year-old kid, and he's just like, you know, just shooting the shit with me. Hey, so you like to train? You run track and field? At that time, I ran track and field, and I kickboxed. We talked training for a while. Franco Colombo was there. If anybody knows who Franco Colombo is, he's another bodybuilder from that era. Was just kind of hanging out. It was just like, wow, this is really cool.
So you continued your life. You said you were 11 at the time. You continued your athletic endeavors, first in track and field, and eventually your body made you realize that I'm probably not cut out for track and field. So you transitioned into football.
Right.
And so that turned into you playing for a couple of years in college until injuries derailed your football career, correct?
Right. And so I played all kinds of sports growing up. I ran my first love was kickboxing and track and field. I played football and I liked it, but I really liked kickboxing and I really loved track and field. But as I started to mature, my body was maturing into this thing that was not a sprinter. And I was beginning to, you know, for the first time in my young career, again, using air quotes that don't transfer well, for the first time in my young career, I started losing races, right? And I would lose races towards the end of the race where I was just getting walked down. And my coach at the time was an excellent track and field coach in San Antonio. And he had this feeder program, much like AAU basketball is now. He had this AAU track and field program. And AAU at that time was the feeder for the U.S. Olympic teams. That's how they found their young talent. And they still do to some extent now. But he brought me on this team because I had gone with an older friend of mine who was in AAU track and field too. And I was just kind of, you know, being a kid and like mimicking the workouts that the track guys were actually doing. I was mimicking them off on the side, and he kept looking over and he was like, what club are you with? And I was like, I'm not with a club. And he's like, you are now. Come here. And he kind of signed me up and he started coaching me then. But anyway, as I matured, he knew, I mean, he had a good coach's eye. He knew, mm-hmm. you know, this kid's not going to be even a decent collegiate sprinter. But he did tell me, hey, you're quick. I mean, and you should concentrate on football because you're football quick. You're not sprinter quick, but you're football quick. And which kind of broke my heart at the time, but I get it now. And I did. I totally flipped and went full force into football.
I'm sure years later you can appreciate the honesty that person, that coach was willing to give to you, since we live in a world where that is very hard for a lot of
right.
people, where it's much easier to be passive aggressive about things. So for right. him to be upfront with you about that, I'm sure that that helped out, and that's something that you enjoy years later.
Yeah, oh, totally, totally. And I certainly appreciate, and I know what he saw. So, you know, after getting into coaching myself, being involved in athletics for so long, I could see now what he saw then. And yeah, there was no, I mean, even in the calf development in a kid, you can tell mm-hmm. if that kid is a sprinter or not.
So you played for a couple of years at what is now Texas State. Back right. then it was Southwest Texas State. And after you injured your left ACL and MCL, you knew the right. football career was over with. You end up leaving school at some point after that and enlisting in the Navy.
Right.
And you spent, I'm assuming, the next 4 years traveling the world.
9 years, in fact.
Nine yeah. years traveling the world,
yep.
serving our country, obviously. What are some of the things that you still hold with you to this day from that 9 years of experience of being in the Navy?
Well, first of all, I'll back up to my football career.
Oh, please do.
That because this sets me up for the military side of it is, you know, as I went on through high school and then went to college, I was fully invested. There was no plan B, right? If you were to, which sounds crazy to me now, and I look back on it, I'm like, it's kind of silly to say, but
fully invested in playing professionally?
Playing professionally, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, really, if I look back on that, there was no reason to question otherwise. I was excellent at my position. I knew the game, and so I knew the X's and O's of the game, and I had adequate athletic ability to be able to play at the next level. And I put everything, my entire identity was wrapped up in being a football player. That was it, total. If you were to ask me at any time, it was just a definite. I'm, you know, playing pro ball. After that, I don't know, but I do know I'm playing pro ball. Which is crazy to think of it now, but I, from the defensive side, I actually audibled into the blitz that I got mangled. So I kind of called my own number. It was a safety delay blitz, and I saw the, you know, it was the perfect formation to pull it off. I audibled into it, and, you know, the next thing I know, my knee is destroyed, completely destroyed. And so having never been injured up until that point, to having a career-ending injury in just one flash, 1 second, boom, over and done, it was devastating, totally devastating. And I went into what I would call now a depression.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my entire identity was stripped. I didn't have any direction whatsoever. But I was smart enough. One of the smartest decisions I've ever made in my young life was I have to leave this atmosphere. Otherwise, just being on this campus and being here is going to remind me of playing football. And I'm going to spiral down. I loved my time at Texas State.
Mm-hmm.
It was Southwest Texas State at the time. I absolutely loved it, but I knew I've got to get away from it if I'm ever going to heal. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? I have like zero skills. I'm a good laborer. And I actually considered going out west and working the oil fields because it was good money at that time.
Lucrative, sure.
And in fact, I would have done that had I not played college football. That was my, you know, I had zero academic wants or desire, didn't even know what I wanted.
You're saying that when you graduated high school, had you not gone to college, you would have ended up in the oil field.
Right. And that's a whole other story of, you know, I really, my thirst for learning was really awakened when I was at college, because that was the first time someone pushed me to create my own thoughts. It's like, I don't want to hear what you're regurgitating. I want you to give me your thought. What do you think about it? And I thought, wow, someone wants to know what I think about it. And I can say what I'm reading, I think is bullshit. Mm-hmm. And we can have a discussion about it.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm in. And so that really woke that up in me. And so I became a lifelong learner when I went to college.
Boy, that's fascinating to hear, because you see so many examples of kids who maybe they get through high school and they receive the label, well, college is probably not for him. He's not the most excited learner right now, but it could very well be the educational system that that person has been in up to that point. So yeah, if it's something that they're even mildly interested in, it's probably worth a pursuit on some level.
Right. Totally. And it was me in my case. I became a pretty good student when I was in college. I mean, you know, the first year was rough because I didn't have any study skills, and, you know, I wasn't used to being in that atmosphere. But the second year, I was really starting to catch fire and really getting into it. And I really got into psychology, and psychology as it applies to coaching is really what I was really fascinated by. How do you motivate someone to play at their highest levels, right? Because I'd been surrounded by guys who were better athletes than I was that, for whatever reason, would not do the requisite work to make themselves better.
Hmm.
They wouldn't do the work in the film room. They wouldn't do the proper prep, and they might be great athletes, but eventually they lost out because they weren't willing to do the work, right? They're kind of the flip of a Michael Jordan,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, Michael Jordan was a fabulous athlete, and he did the work. You could say that, you know, the same of anyone at that level. Tiger Woods, when he was at the top of the game, and the LeBron James now. I don't think anybody could question his athleticism, but he does the work, too, on top of that. And what motivates these guys? That's kind of stuff fascinated me. So after being injured – at that time, if you could not play, you lost your scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the coaching staff at Southwest Texas at that time were working with me. They're like, hey, we'll keep you on for the next 2 years if you want, right? Mm-hmm. We'll keep you on scholarship. You know, you've done us well. We'll do you well. But I just could not stay in that atmosphere. It was just bringing me down. I was like, I can't be around this if I can't be on the field. It's killing me. So I went to the next best thing, the next best boys club that I could be in, and that was the military.
The oil field was an option. Military, right, obviously an option. Was there anything else under consideration for you, or did you pretty quickly realize that the Navy was the best route?
Yeah, that was it. That was, and by this time I knew that, and the reason I chose to go into the military was, and I had enough sense at this time to realize, you know, you can't twist a wrench forever. Right. You can make some really, really good money on the oil field, but roughnecking is hard work, man. Mm-hmm. I give it up to those guys because it is tough, dangerous work. And it's not an old man's game at all. And I thought, you know, if I put all of my eggs in this basket, in this sports basket, and that was taken from me immediately, it can happen again, worse. So I'm going to have to find out something that I can do for a lifetime. And, you know, working as a roughneck, not going to be it. As much as I appreciate the hard work and the labor that goes into it, and I appreciate everybody who does that kind of work, I wanted to try to find something that I could do for a lifetime. And so, you know, I think I can find that through the military. Maybe. I really didn't know. I just kind of threw the dice and went with it. And really, I went with it because it was a boys club. I mean, at that time, it was Top Gun time. I was like, all right, this is kind of
this would have been the mid-80s, right around when Top Gun came out.
Right. And I thought, yeah, you know, I can do that. I can, because I also love being around that enthusiasm and that testosterone-fueled atmosphere. I mean, it's one reason why I loved coaching too. I mean, just to get back in the weight room with college athletes and, you know, blast the music, and it just, I mean, it's the best for me. It's one of the best places in the world to be.
That's the seemingly glamorous side of what it was that you were getting yourself into. Was there a reality check early on that let you know the other side of that dream?
Yeah, there's definitely a reality check. Like, you know, all the training and all of it, yeah, it was difficult, super difficult. But it, you know, hey, I'd been through football training forever, which is, you know, grueling, punishing. So that part of it was not hard. I think just the grind. So being in the military is unlike sports in that when you're playing a sport, you know, next week is go time. Even when you're in the off season, you can picture when you're going to have to perform. In the military, it's not that way. You might go 2 years and not have to perform, but you're still having to do the training. You're still having to go through all the workups. You're still having to do all that. And there's kind of no way to really express the ultimate goal of that training. And, you know, on the flip side of that, thank God we're not in wars all the time. You know, thank God we're not having to do this. But for the person who's prepping for that, that's a psychological toll.
That great unknown is especially has to be the case in the Navy, because even if something gets started war-wise or military-wise to where you have to have a presence there, if you're not already docked in that area, it's right. going to take you some time to get there still.
Right. And so it's this massive waiting game. So you go on deployment for 6, 8, 9 months, and you're just, we called it box ops. So I was primarily deployed in the Mediterranean for the most part. And literally the ships would just do box maneuvers, like one big 40-mile box. And why? Because you have to get ready. I mean, it's like a boxer in the ring getting ready to come out for the next round. Only the next round might be 25 years, right? So, but you've got to be ready, and you've got to be on cue, and you've got to be ready to go at the last minute. And that's just the nature of the military.
Were you ever involved in any combat, or if not, what was the closest that you came to that?
So I was serving right at the time when the wall came down, which is interesting because I can remember being in West Berlin, and I think we might have talked about this at another time, but somewhere there's a blackmail picture of me looking very Tom Cruise, wearing a blue Levi's jacket, drinking a beer in West Berlin and flipping off the guard at Checkpoint Charlie. Ray-Bans, you know, the whole looking very, very American, flipping off the guard at Checkpoint Charlie. And obviously on the other side of that wall is East Germany. So I was there to see that. And I was also in Berlin to see the United Germanies. But what a lot of people don't realize is what a powder keg the world was at that time. I mean, it was, you had, I can't remember the leader of Romania at that time, but he was beheaded on Christmas Day. There were a lot of these rogue nations that had access to nuclear weapons, and you kind of didn't know what they were going to do. You had no idea. It was just, for better or worse, the USSR at that time was able to contain all these satellite countries. But now there's nobody had control, and it was kind of up to the U.S. military to keep a wet blanket on that the entire time. And it was a dicey situation. No actual firefights, nothing like that. Never came to that, thank God. Because yeah.
For all the tension that existed around that time, being on a boat, and I know this because I have family who does or has served in the Navy specifically, there's plenty of downtime on the boat as well. Were you utilizing any of this downtime to further your knowledge base for what you now know in health and wellness?
You know, I read everything I could get my hands on. And I would say, too, that very early on, in my late high school and in my college days, I was lucky enough to be trained by people who were starting to get access to East German training methodologies. In the East Germans at that time trained very, very different than folks in the U.S. trained. I can get into the specifics of that, but it's way deep.
Is there one base idea that was drastically different that was leading to the result? But beyond the obvious of them using performance-enhancing drugs at the same time, was there some other methodology, whether it was a version of Tabata or some other strength training method that they were utilizing that was putting them so far ahead?
Right. I would say that the best example of what the East Germans were doing training wise, and this is for any athlete, it didn't matter if they were weightlifters or sprinters or what their thing was. If you look at Westside, the way Westside trains, Westside Gym, Louis Simmons, he's taken that methodology and used it primarily for powerlifting. But he's using the base templates of what they were doing in the Eastern Bloc.
Is that going different percentages of what your personal?
Yep.
Okay, yeah,
yeah. That was totally different than what we were doing in the U.S. So in the U.S., if you were training to be a sprinter, you sprinted, right, and you avoided weights at all costs.
Bad idea.
The East German idea was you sprinted a little. You worked on technique, but you were lifting heavy, heavy weights, which was in the U.S. We have just recently started to pick that up in the U.S. And I say recently, I'm an old guy now, but before 2000, that was still kind of an iffy concept in the U.S., U.S. training. I can tell you the Eastern Bloc and the Russians were using serious loads on their sprinters. And so I was able to get my hands on a lot of that material. I had... How can I say access? I was able to. There's lots of trading that goes on in the military that people don't know about. There's all kinds of trading. Like if you can get your hands on, for instance, foodstuffs, right? So the first thing you do when you're on a ship is you make good friends with whoever the food staff is, right, and whoever's working the galleys and stuff, because you can then take that and trade it for other goods, right? Well, I had this pipeline where I was able to get my hands on these kind of obscure documents that were translated into English, very, very poor. And so I continued my knowledge of strength and training in that way.
Wait a second. You're telling me that you traded food for translated documents that were letting you know what the East German Olympic team was doing.
Right.
Man, well, that is a dedication there.
Yeah, yeah. It was just happenstance. You have people who have, there's vast libraries in the military complex. It wasn't, even when I think back, it wasn't that big a deal. I mean, it was just like, hey, I've got 18 pounds of coffee. Can you round up this book for me? Yeah, we can do that.
Barter system's an effective one.
Yeah, it's just, and there's all kinds of trading that goes on like that in the military. But yeah, so that was just one aspect, though, to be able to read these documents, and they were interesting to nobody else. Nobody else would even consider them interesting, but I thought they were interesting because I knew that the secret to success with especially the East Germans was far and beyond their doping program, because at the end of the day, they only had so many athletes to choose from. You think East Germany was about the size of Virginia population wise, and they were consistently 1, 2, and 3 with the USSR and the US in the Olympics. And so that's like taking the population of Virginia and fielding an Olympic team and being on par with the Russians and the Americans.
And if we're being honest, we could ask questions about just how clean the programs for those other two
Everybody
countries were
doping.
As well.
Everybody was doping. In the US was doping just along with anybody else, because that's all part of the game. I mean, that's, the doping, the avoiding being caught, all of that is just part of the game. So if that's it, if everybody's doping, then it comes back to training again, right? So you have to be able to train those athletes because now the bar has been raised to a certain level. Okay, all these athletes are doping. Now what? Mm-hmm. Well, you have to train them. Still have to put the work in. Yeah. And it's the Barry Bonds thing, right? So you can say Barry Bonds juiced, he did whatever. Yeah, I get it. He still had to put a bat on the ball. He still had to have the reflexes. He still had to have the eyesight. He still had to know the game.
We could have a totally separate conversation on the fake morality that comes into the PED conversation, but we'll save that for another day, Keith. I want to continue hearing your story because during this 9 years, and I apologize if I'm getting the timeline a little bit incorrect, you at least met or were continuing to date your now wife, Michelle. Did you meet her while you were in the military? Had you met her prior to that?
I actually knew her in high school.
Okay.
So it's a pretty crazy story. We were actually friends in high school. We kind of hung out in the same cliques, and she actually used to set me up on dates. So she doesn't do that anymore, unfortunately. But no, she used to, back in the day, she would. And I can say that every girlfriend that I had through Michelle was the only sane girlfriends that I had. So she was able to pick them pretty good. And we reconnected after I got out of the military. Okay. We were both going through divorces, separate divorces at the time. And we met back up. It's the power of the young internet at that time. This was around 7-ish, 8-ish, around in there. Yeah.
And so that would have been after you were out of the Navy. Now, when you when you got out of the Navy, I believe you went back to school, got your degree at SUNY, University of Albany.
I actually finished my degree while I was in.
You got out of the Navy, a college-educated guy who also had military experience. What was the next step for you?
This was a choice I had at that time. So I had my degree. I was doing very, very well, and I was offered the opportunity to go to JAG school, to go to law school through the military.
Yeah.
And I seriously considered it. I thought, you know, I had studied political science and psychology in school and got my degree in poli-sci. I was very, very interested in that and still am. So at that point, I'm kind of sitting at year six when this is going on. And I knew that if I went on, that I was going to have to make the military a career, because once you break kind of the 10-year point, I mean, you're invested that long, you need to go ahead and stay in for the 20. It just makes sense. So I had a decision to make. Do I go to school, or do I get out and, you know, do whatever after I get out? And I happen to have friends that were friends of mine in college, had gone to law school, are now working for firms. And they told me, don't do it, because it looks great on the outside, but it is a grind. And knowing you, we don't think that you will enjoy doing this. And I thought, you know, I heard that from a couple people, and I thought, well, you know, maybe they're disgruntled. I get it. People get disgruntled. But I heard it from a couple more. And it was just one of those major life decisions. I just thought, you know, let me sit back. Let me listen to my gut and listen to what my gut says. And so I passed on going to law school. And my family thought I was absolutely crazy. The first time they thought I was absolutely crazy. Second time was when I decided to leave Big Pharma and strike out on my own. But they thought I was absolutely crazy. They're like, they're offering to pay for you to go to law school.
When you decided not to do that and you had exited the military, was the next step working for Big Pharma?
Yeah. So I went to work for Big Pharma, which is kind of ironic now where I sit. But yeah, I went to work for Big Pharma. Big Pharma at that time was the place to be. It was, if you wanted to go into an industry that was moving fast, both in the research and development side of things, and in just the growth of the industry, that was the place to be. And I had an opportunity to go to work for Big Pharma, and I took it. And at that time, I thought, what better way to serve both myself and my family and serve humanity at the same time? And that was the thought I had then. And that changed after about 5 years, when I, you know, started rising to a level to where I got to kind of take a peek behind the curtain and see what's really going on, how the sausage is being made in Big Pharma. You get to see where the research and development money is being funneled. You get to see the lack of interest in doing things that don't make a whole lot of money, like the next antibiotic, for instance. There's just not any money in it. And so they don't pursue it. They let, you know, the academic side try to pick that up and figure it out. There's just not money in it. And I get it. They're in business to make money. And that's what businesses do. Businesses exist to make money. But I couldn't, I had this cognitive dissonance going on after a while that I eventually couldn't, you know, I couldn't keep it up.
A common thought regarding big pharma, and I'm certainly guilty of this from time to time, but it's a popular opinion in the paleo community as well, is that big pharma is not necessarily out to help you out in ways that they could. And I feel like a lot of people, and again, I am guilty of this from time to time as well, wonder if there is a more evil ulterior motive. Is it more about money than anything else with big pharma? If there's something that happens that has you scratching your head, just wondering why something is being done, isn't being done differently? Does it really come down to money 99% of the time and what you saw?
Right. So, you know, on the individual level, so this is where it gets really, really tricky. And it's almost like conspiracy theories, right?
Right.
It's,
and I feel like that's where myself and other people tend to go sometimes, because you see these secrets uncovered.
Right.
And it's like, well, you had the evidence showing that this is the case, yet you chose to just kind of ignore that, sweep it under the rug while you continued about your business.
Right. No, and for sure, there is things that go on in big pharma that are totally detrimental to people's health, and they're done in the name of money. But if you were to grab any random employee at a big pharma, they were like I was back in the late 90s. They think that they are doing humanity a service, and they are really putting their heart and soul into their jobs, and they're doing good work. Although I left big pharma, and I left because I saw where the money was being made, and I just knew there was a different way to make people healthy, and big pharma was not pursuing that. I am not a big pharma hater. I can say that. I understand where they're coming from. If you know the nature of the beast, it's kind of like your opponent, right? I know your hook and I know your jab. You know, I don't hate you for it, but that's what you got. And you're trying to use that to defeat me. I don't hate you for it. That is what you do. Big pharma exists to make money. But I don't have to play your game either. And I don't have to be silent about it. I can tell people what I know, and I can coach people to where they don't need big pharma. And that is kind of where PaleoFX is.
Mm-hmm.
Big pharma makes some drugs that save lives,
mm-hmm.
right? If I get hit by a bus when I leave here, I want a surgeon who is super adept at his craft, and I want life-saving drugs. And I think everybody is in that boat. But when we talk about diseases of modernity, and when I say diseases of modernity, that's obesity, diabetes, heart disease. Those are the big three. And I would add lack of muscle mass, or just exercise in general, cardiovascular health and muscular health. I would add that to the list too, because that's the other thing that we never discuss in this country is that. But those three things can be served and corrected without any pharmaceuticals whatsoever, even if a person is in the full-blown condition right now. So say a person is obese and diabetic, and you know his coronary numbers don't look all that good either. That can be corrected with exercise and diet, no problem. And it's been shown over and over and over and over that it's effective. Big pharma doesn't want you to know that, right? Because there's zero money in that, none. But there's a lot of money if you keep somebody on a diabetic drug for their entire life. That's a lot of money. That's a lifelong customer.
That's right.
Right.
And oftentimes, the drugs that are being given to people, even if it helps address whatever the primary symptom is, it creates other symptoms in the process.
Right.
And those are other symptoms that you then have to treat with more drugs. It's a vicious cycle.
It is a vicious cycle. And what's crazy to me too is, and this is kind of getting away from big pharma and more on the insurance and government side of things, but our government subsidizes the very foods that are making us sick, which is crazy. So we have this whole system set up, and the only way that system can continue churning is if there's sick people involved. Sick people require big pharma. Sick people require insurance. The government subsidizes foods that make us sick. And so if you want a conspiracy theory, when I kind of stand back and look at it, I'm like, they've got this huge system going on that nobody at the upper levels is ever going to break. Because in reality, if you look at the GDP that's sucked up in healthcare, if everybody in the US decided to, hey, I'm going to change my life tomorrow and I'm going to be healthy and I'm going to take care of it with diet and exercise, would freaking bankrupt this country quickly. It would just come to a halt.
considering what's happening with healthcare in this country, that speaks to the need for individuals to gain a better grasp of their own health, to where you right. don't become so reliant on this system that is clearly broken right now. And you mentioned that at one point, about 5 years in, you realize this is not something that you wanted to be doing for the rest of your life. The thought started to brew for doing something different. What ultimately spurred you into action to then transition from big pharma into the world of health and wellness?
Right. Well, I would say, too, that my wife, Michelle, was in the same boat, right? So both of us had, at that time, what we call the, you know, it's the golden handcuff situation. I was making very, very good money in big pharma. She was making good money at her job. She happened to work for a company that built Starbucks up and down the East Coast. And she was a project manager doing that. So we were both doing very well. And what do you do when you're very well? You buy the big house, you buy the cars, you put your kids in the best schools, all the things, right? Because that's what you're supposed to do. That's the American dream.
And those turn into big annual payments.
Those turn into big annual payments. And then once you kind of see the light and you see what's going on and you're like, hey, I don't want to play this game anymore. It's not that easy. It's not that easy to back yourself out of that vortex then. It's very, very difficult to back out of it. So we made a plan that when our kids were either, all of them, either in college or out on their own or otherwise taking care of themselves, we saved money for that point so that we could back completely out, where she would quit and I would quit. And we didn't know exactly what we were going to do, but we knew it was not this. We were not going to be caught up in this corporate America thing. And we had an idea that we were both entrepreneurs. We had that itch that we wanted to create our own thing. Mm-hmm. She knew that she wanted, she was either going to be a chef, open a restaurant, or do a catering type thing because that was her passion. I knew I was going to move into training, owning gyms, doing things of that nature because that was my passion. But other than that, we really didn't know. We just were saving money and getting ready to pull out. And unfortunately, 2008 hit. We were heavily invested in real estate at that time, and we pretty much lost just about everything we had.
Were y'all based out of Austin at that time?
We were in North Carolina at that time. Greenville, North Carolina.
Okay.
That's where we lived, yeah.
So was there a point after that that you made your way back to Texas? And I know that even though you were in Central Texas for college, you grew up in South Texas. Michelle grew up in South Texas as well, I believe, since you guys knew one another in high school. So at what point did you move back to Central Texas?
So we tried to get out of all of our real estate holdings at the worst possible time, you know, the bottom of the housing crisis. We were heavily invested in real estate. Because
having to sell short in a lot of instances.
Oh, my God. We got skinned totally to the point to where we still don't own any real estate.
So
we're like, we have a little bit of PTSD from that time. But, something we'll have to get over. But because before that, we were so heavily invested in tech and we – you know, we lost our shirts in 99-2000 because of that crash, but consider ourselves very lucky because we were still heavily invested in real estate at that time. And real estate never goes anywhere, right?
Not so.
Except in 2008.
Not so.
And so we were trying to pick ourselves up from that, and we were still totally invested in you know, getting out and doing our own thing. And our daughter was in college at Georgia, a small school in Georgia. And we were out at a, I'll never forget it, of course, we were out at a Kentucky Derby party. Some friends of ours were throwing a Kentucky Derby party. Mm-hmm. Beautiful night. We had a great time. And we were driving home and we noticed a car that was parked in front of our house that we really didn't recognize, which was kind of odd in that neighborhood that we lived in. So we pulled into the driveway and Michelle's phone started ringing at that same time. And it was just this odd feeling when we pulled up and I got out of the truck. She was trying to fumble and find her phone. And as she was answering her phone, I could hear the person on the other end saying, "Oh my God, Michelle, the police are trying to get up with you." And I was trying to make sense of that. And then there was a gentleman walking down our driveway and he was asking Keith Norris and Michelle Norris. And yeah, long story short, our daughter had died in an auto accident. So yeah, so that it will be 10 years this May 3rd that that happened. So obviously devastating on top of everything else.
Was this after you guys had already quit your respective jobs and we were trying to
undo what we could on the real estate side of things and trying to make sense of what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But the game plan was still on. We were still in.
Okay.
We were still moving towards that. Michelle, prior to Brittany's passing, had Howard Schultz had come back on as CEO of Starbucks at that time, and he was starting to close existing stores.
Mm-hmm.
And Michelle's building new stores. And I remember being in my office one day, and a friend of mine came in and said, hey, man, have you seen the stock ticker? What's going on with Starbucks? Because he knew Michelle, you know, was involved with Starbucks. And I said, I haven't paid any attention to it today. He's like, you ought to check it out because Howard Schultz is doing something. I don't know, but the Starbucks stock is going crazy. I was like, okay. So I did a little digging. I found out that he was closing existing stores. I called up Michelle, and before I could even say, hey, what's going on? She's like, I know. She's like, this gig isn't going to last. Just telling you, we've got maybe a week at best, and we're going to get laid off. And sure enough, so she got laid off from that job, which was okay. She's like, hey, you know, I will get the real estate set. I'll take care of doing all of that. We won't have to pay for an agent because I can do it. But then the bottom fell out of the housing market. In fact, our personal house, the day we put the sign in the yard was the next day the paper market was cut.
Gosh.
We joked that we caused the housing crisis, and that was September 13th of that year. And we put our personal house on the market on September 12th. I'm telling you, you couldn't write this script. It was rather incredible.
The loss that the two of you experienced with your daughter, Brittany, like, it breaks my heart to hear about it right now. And I know it's been a number of years since then, but as somebody who has a wife and two young children, I just can't even fathom something that is a nightmare for parents everywhere.
Yeah, it is. It was incredibly tough, and it still is, but really we used it as motivation, right? And so, at the worst we were financially, it looked bleak for a long period of time. And there was some times where we thought, you know, I'm just going to have to suck it up and continue in this industry. I don't know, you know, any way out. Those thoughts would enter my mind and we would immediately put them out because we thought, you know, we have made it through the death of a daughter. How bad can it get? I mean, bankruptcy, really? Whatever. I mean, it was just, you know, so are we going to live the rest of our lives being unhappy with the knowledge that we did not do what we wanted to do? Or are we going to take a chance? And what would she have us do? And that ultimately is what pushed us to go, no, we're going to continue through and do what we want to do.
The grieving process is a long one. In a situation like this, it's one that probably never totally ends, as you just kind of hinted at. I would assume that there were months, if not maybe more than that, between when Brittany passed away and when you guys finally decided to make that decision.
Right. Yeah, the grieving process is horrible, as you might imagine. It was a tough – that the year after she passed was incredibly tough. But we just kept pushing forward. And we, you know, once we got – out of all the real estate that we were invested in, I still remember when I walked into the office the day that I resigned,
mm-hmm.
you know, and because there was that feeling up until the end, you know, am I doing the right thing? Are we doing the right thing? But yeah, and ultimately what it was, would Brittany want us to continue doing what we're doing, or would she want us to chase our dreams? And that's ultimately what made us become entrepreneurs you couldn't find a worse possible time to come out and be entrepreneurs. And our family really thought that we had lost our mind, that we had some kind of a reaction to Brittany's loss that caused us to like just completely lose it, and for good cause. I mean, we were in rough shape for that year.
How profound is her presence on the decisions that you guys are still making to this day?
She is so wrapped up into Paleo FX. It is, you know, her gift was ministry and music. She went to school to be a minister. Mm-hmm. And which are not Michelle and I's gifts, mm-hmm. but she changed so many lives, and that was her passion, was to change lives for the better. She went about it in her way, and we thought, you know, that legacy, we want to be a part of that. We want to change lives for the better. Now, we're not, you know, we're not inclined spiritually that way, and we're certainly not musicians, so we can't change lives that way. But there's one thing we do know is health and wellness. And so, you know, I tell people that is how I can make my dent in the universe, right? I'm not the guy that's going to split the atom. I am not, you know, I am not the sharpest tool in the shed, but what I do know, I can make people healthy. I do know that. I am an expert at habit change. I can get people to change habits that they have tried their entire lives to change and cannot do it. I just happen to have that superpower. That's my gift. So if I can make somebody healthy and I can unleash that potential within them that right now is buried under poor health, they're going to change the world in a special way.
It's the body is the temple idea that is right. Not explored enough by even a lot of religious people for all the different ways that they better themselves and better other people. One of the ways that you can maximize that is by making sure that you are at full strength.
Right.
And so the body is the temple thing is something that hopefully people continue to pay more attention to going forward. So after you quit your job, obviously a profound day for you, one that still sticks out. You guys get out from under the weight of owning different properties. Was the next move to come to Austin? And if so, what was it that caused you to move back here?
Well, we've always loved Austin. Austin was always on our short list. Mm-hmm. And being from having grown up in San Antonio, going to school in San Marcos, which is just down the road here, I've always loved Austin, even as a kid. Mm-hmm. I've always just loved the vibe of Austin. So that was, we were always shortlisted here. As I was starting to put out feelers in the Austin area, I ran into a gentleman, Mark Alexander, who had a gym concept that I thought, yeah, I kind of like that concept. So I had a couple choices. I could just come down and open my own outfit, or I could partner with somebody who was already kind of moving in that direction and that we, you know, we could come to terms and agree. And that's what wound up happening. So I wound up partnering with Mark Alexander at Efficient Exercise Gyms. And that was, you know, it was such a whirlwind. We left North Carolina, moved, and it was like 2 days later, I'm working with Mark and, you know, and starting the entrepreneur thing.
What year was this?
This was 2009.
Okay, so this would have been 3 years before you officially got Paleo FX started up.
2011 is when we had the idea for Paleo FX.
2011 was?
2011.
Flying then, back from Los Angeles.
Right, yeah.
And whenever you guys moved back here to Austin, did Michelle get into food at that point?
She did.
I know that she ultimately was doing catering events.
Right.
Did she still consider the idea for restaurants? Restaurants are clearly something that are very difficult to get going.
Right.
Did she talk to enough people in the business to realize that if she wanted to explore this as a career, she would be better off doing it on the other side of things?
Right. So, and especially in Austin, I don't know if people realize, but Austin is the epicenter of food and restaurants. I mean, there are so many fabulous restaurants here and rock star chefs. It's just amazing.
And that was right around the time that this whole scene blew up, too, because I think back to when I lived here in the early 2000s, and there were some decent places to eat, but it took things to another level about a decade ago.
Right. And it kills me to see some of the restaurants that go out of business that are just rock star chefs, but that's the competition. Mm-hmm. Everybody's here trying to hone their game, And you have a population that's just, they get used to it, right? That's just the way it is. I mean, if you travel away from Austin, and not to take away from other areas of the country that have fabulous chefs, that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just saying that the concentration here in Austin, you just get very spoiled to it quickly. Just having fabulous food just on every corner. She came into that, and we did consider restaurants. She had been involved in the business for long enough to realize that any restaurant is a gamble. It doesn't matter how good the chef is. It just, restaurants are like events. There are so many things that can go wrong in a restaurant experience. It's mm-hmm. over and above the food quality. So she decided that she would rather get her feet wet catering, because there's a little bit more control there when you're in a catering environment. But yeah, whether you're catering or you're a chef at a restaurant, those are long, long hours. And I don't think people see the chef shows on TV and it looks very glamorous. I can tell you it's some 14-hour days of just grinding, and it's hot.
Considering what interests the two of you in terms of how you live your life, and also how health-conscious Austin is, was there a focus early on for her to providing healthier but still tasty options to people?
Right. Her entire catering scheme revolved around the paleo idea. Hmm. So it was from the get-go, it was gluten-free, grain-free, dairy-free in most instances. It was locally sourced. It was all the paleo things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's a concept that she came in with, and she did great. I mean, her company did fantastic. And we, it's kind of strange, because if you were to ask me in 2011 what I would be doing in 2020, I would say, well, I plan on being the next Jack LaLanne, and I'll have a franchise gym establishment. That's what I'll be doing in 2020. Michelle would tell you that she would probably have a restaurant attached to her catering business. The idea that we would have an event was not even on the radar.
Well, things change, as you
things
just said. Things have changed for the better for you guys since you made that move to Austin. And you've really become a household name in the ancestral health community. You seem to know just a ton of people, and to be able to connect people with one another as well. It's part of the reason why I'm speaking with you right now. Right. You introduced me to Craig, and he and I have gotten along, and now here we are. How do you establish and maintain these relationships and determine how to best collaborate with people, or how to best pit individuals with one another?
Right. You know, I actually love that aspect. I actually love, in my mental Rolodex, kind of imagining in my mind, what would it be like if Trey and Craig got together? Because I know they're both very interested in podcast and broadcasting. I think that would be an interesting combination. But I do that in all business areas. And I have just always been one of those people, although I am not an extrovert by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. I can pretend to be an extrovert for a while, and I do so at Paleo FX. But I'm an introvert by nature, but I love people in small groups.
Okay.
And I love talking with people one-on-one and in small groups. I really enjoy that. And I've just always had that knack, even as a kid, of being able to go, oh, you need to meet so-and-so. And I don't know where that comes from. And I don't know why that is, but I love connecting those dots. And I read at one point, because I was really, really deep in human psychology, again, reading this, and I had read over and over by some of the Norman Vincent Peale and all of these old school, even Tony Robbins would tell you that your network is your net worth. And I always remember, kind of going, yeah, I can see that. But of course, I wasn't an entrepreneur at the time. It really didn't make a lot of sense. Well, it makes a lot of sense now, because that's essentially what PaleoFX is. It was just our network that we brought in under one roof.
Who is somebody that you have not had the chance to work with yet, but would like to, and why?
Well, this is interesting. So Joel Kahn, who is a vegetarian, Dr. Joel Kahn.
Mm-hmm. Just on Joe Rogan's podcast.
Right, right. We have been looking for a long period of time to bring in a high-profile vegetarian into Paleo FX, and not because we want to turn it into a, you know, Jerry Springer show, but we really want to have that conversation. We know that we don't know everything there is to know about health and wellness.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. We do know that we can look at some vegetarians and they look very healthy. But we know that I can also look at some, like Sean Baker, for instance, Dr. Sean Baker, who is a carnivore and very healthy. And so what are the underlying attributes of this? So we wanted someone on the vegetarian side of things to come in and give his point of view. And that, which is probably crazy to hear from people from the paleo guy, that I'm most excited to have a vegetarian come in. But I think the contrast is going to be just fabulous. And when Michelle and I set out at Paleo FX, we said the one thing, we don't know what we are going to do in the years to come because we don't know what this thing is going to become. Hmm. And we're just kind of keeping guardrails on it and letting it be its own thing, which is difficult to do as an entrepreneur because you want to get in and fix everything. But we're just kind of keeping guardrails and just letting it become, just letting it be what it's going to be. But the one thing we said was what we're not going to do is be an echo chamber. So if we were an echo chamber, we would not reach out to Joel Kahn and have him come in because you don't fit within your voice does not resonate in this chamber at all. But we're constantly doing that. I want to hear other voices. I want other input. And again, not in a Jerry Springer way, but you totally, speaking to Joel, you totally believe in this lifestyle. What is it? What are you seeing that makes you believe it? Right? Or, you know, what science are you looking at? How are you squaring this? And then on the flip side of things, because I'm obviously not a vegetarian, but I'm not, you know, a total carnivore either. So I want to hear the same thing from Sean Baker.
I don't care what the idea is. If you cannot have a conversation with somebody who disagrees with how you believe, right, then it makes your own idea suspect, right, as well, which speaks to your echo chamber idea.
Right, right. And that's, I think I've been inoculated to this because of being involved in strength and conditioning my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are so many camps. And this was true even back in the 70s. There were camps in the 70s of how training should be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always the one that was, I just happened to go to a gym when I was younger that was both a bodybuilding gym, a powerlifting gym, and a traditional weightlifting gym. I got to see everything. I got to see track and field athletes being trained. I got to see bodybuilders prepping for contests. I got to see football players train, and they were being trained by good coaches. And so I saw this mix in this mixing of different methodologies and knowledge. And that just always stuck with me. And that stuck with me my entire life. And I do the same thing at Paleo FX. So, you know, while I do really appreciate lifting weights, and that is my thing, I still do lots of cardio. I still rode my bike 10 miles today, and it was a fixed speed bike. And, you know, I went to go get a haircut, and I thought, I'm not going to have a whole lot of time, but I am going to get in some exercise. So I'll hop on the bike, ride the bike over to the barber, and then ride back. So it's all the things. It's a proper mix of the things. It's never the one thing.
One of the things I really appreciate about Paleo FX is the affordability for your average person. Maybe it's somebody who lives here in Austin. Maybe it's somebody who is interested in visiting this great city and partaking in one of the great health and wellness conferences in this country, if not the world. Why is it so important for you to keep Paleo FX affordable to people?
Yeah, and we have really been over backwards to be able to do that. And you can thank, or we can thank, the exhibitors and sponsors for allowing us to be able to keep the ticket prices low because, and I know when people come into the show and they, you know, they see the thousands of people there and they do the mental math, they're like, you know, the average ticket price is about $500. We have some lower, some higher. You do the quick mental math and you're like, these guys are banking. But putting on events is incredibly expensive. Yeah, it is. When you look at the balance sheet, it's both labor intensive and it's cost intensive. But we have done everything possible to keep the ticket prices low because we want people to have access to this information. And we truly, truly think that this battle that we're fighting right now in our country to make people healthy, this really is our civil rights movement of this day and age. I mean, to get people to realize that they are the captains of their own health, and their health is not to be outsourced to the doctor, to the government, or to any other agency. It's theirs and their responsibility. And to have people relearn that, it really is. Because if you don't have your health, you don't have your freedom.
What is it like to have your spouse as a business partner? And has that brought about any surprises in your personal relationship?
Right. So it's the best and the worst, I would say. So yes, I get to work with the love of my life doing exactly what I want to do in my life. And that is special, super special. Mm-hmm. And we are both carrying on the legacy of our daughter, which is special. The downside of it is it's a business. There are tough decisions that need to be made. There are differences of opinion. And when you have people who are super, super passionate, but have different opinions on how things should go, it can get into a firefight. I mean, and it's one thing because I've been in businesses with other partners, and it's the same thing. Passionate people, you're going to butt heads. You're going to, there's going to be a throwdown. You'll pick each other up afterwards, hopefully, and dust each other off and go on. But when you're doing that with your spouse, you're eating dinner together and then you're going to bed together. I mean, you don't ever have that separation, and that's tough.
Mm-hmm.
It has been a challenge to our relationship, as has been every other difficult thing we've done in our relationship, from being in financial straits, from losing a daughter, just one thing after another. We had coached a son through heroin addiction. So we've had to deal with that. But I would say we're in a Talib kind of way, in an anti-fragile kind of way. We're pretty damn tough now. I mean, we've been through a lot, and there's not much that can bring us down.
In a perfect world where your methodology is adopted by everyone, every person on the planet. Yes, it's a far-fetched hypothetical here, but I'm asking it nonetheless. What does the world look like after 5 years, and what does this world look like after 10 years?
Well, first of all, realistically, is it a far-fetched idea? Yes. But in my mind, it is real, and it's already happened, right? And that's the way I see it. That was the same mindset I had when I was a kid playing football. I already see where I'm going to be, right? And then you just live your life accordingly. And that's kind of what both Michelle and I are doing now. We see that vision already. We already see that having happened. And now we're just going behind the scenes and making the bed, so to speak, so that it can happen. The vast amount of money and human suffering tied up in ill health, it really hurts my heart. If I can offer one kid a brighter future and a chance to put a dent in the universe by making that child healthy, that's a win. So I look at it not worldwide, but I look at it at the individual level, right? Every individual. And that's kind of how I see, because when you think of things in large scale, or I do anyway, the emotion kind of gets drained out of it, right? It becomes stats and numbers, and the emotion gets drained out of it. But when I will look at one individual, that's where the emotion comes back in. Now I can have a relational tie with that person, and that makes me work hard, right? So if I could make that one child healthy so that he could go on and dent the universe, that's what we're all about. And we know it can be done.
Love that. You recently expanded to Keto FX. What prompted this expansion, and was the process the same as what it took for Paleo FX early on?
Yeah. So, going back to the business model thing with Paleo FX and us not having a business model, and I've told people for the first 6 years, we were just going crazy, just trying to lay track in front of a freight train that was just barreling down the tracks. It was all we could do to lay track, just to stay ahead of this thing, just to keep the cats herded. and really no business plan around what we were doing. When we finally got to the point to where we can, we have a staff large enough, and that staff grows yearly, and it's just exploding on us, which is another good problem to have, but it's a problem. But we finally just gotten to the point where we can back up, take a breath, and go, okay, let's figure out a business plan. What are we doing with this thing? What is this? Because people can tell you, people who know events have come to us and asked us, how is it that you guys are surviving with only being an event company? Mm-hmm. Because nobody does that. South by Southwest does it, but they've been doing this for 20 some odd years. No, everybody uses events as a loss lead for their company. Everybody does it. You know, if you break even, great. But most people lose money on events. But that's all we have at an event. And I tell them, we just had to figure it out. You know, we didn't go in with a business plan. We had to figure it out. But we do understand, too, that it's relying on an event solely is not a good business plan. You have to bolster it with other things. So, in saying all that, we are repositioning ourselves as a platform company, because that's really what we are. What we are is the biggest repository of paleo knowledge and information anywhere in the world. But people yet still think of us as an event, rightly so, because that's how we've advertised ourselves for 8 years. But we're starting the process of recreating PaleoFX as a platform company that has an event tied to it. So part of that is we will have these summits, these online summits in what we call the off season for us. And keto was a subject that we were very, very interested in. It falls under the paleo umbrella because really it's just the manipulation of the paleo diet, really. And we happen to know a lot of people in the paleo community as far as the people who are researching the material, you know, the Dom DiAgostinos and the Sean Wells and these people and the Louis Villasenors and Rob Wolf even has moved more on the keto side of things. So we knew the people and we knew we could put it together.
So this isn't a chicken or egg question. The idea for the online forum came before KetoFX, but KetoFX is going to be one of your first big rollouts with that side.
Right, and we've already rolled that out. We rolled that out last year. We also had a summit. It was called the Health Hacker FX. It was our version of biohacking.
Oh, wow.
But we wanted to position biohacking such that the average person could have access to it, because right now, when you mention the word biohacking, you think of people like Ben Greenfield, who I love. I think Ben's a great guy, and I love talking to him. I love, you know, working out with him. I love all of that.
Seems like an annual participant at the conference,
too.
He
is, yes. He's an annual participant. But when the average person hears biohacking, they think athlete like Ben. They think implantable chips. They think all kinds of weirdness, right? Mm-hmm. But what they don't realize is that these very simple techniques and these very simple devices can help them rediscover their own health. And it doesn't have to be, you know, craziness. And in fact, lifestyle itself can be a hack. So sleep, for instance. Well, how do you get a great night's sleep? Well, you can use all kinds of tracking devices. I happen to be wearing a ring right now that tracks all my biometrics. But does that really help me sleep? It gives me indications of how I slept, and maybe I can react to that information. But at the end of the day, just the fact that I'm sleeping in a very, very quiet room that's dark, that's at the right temperature, that I've removed all the, you know, the EMFs from my surroundings, that I haven't had been bombarded by blue light before I've gone to bed, all of these things, getting to bed at the right time, all of those things are lifestyle hacks. But what the general public wants to do is, what's the best sleep supplement I can take? And hey, I'm in the supplement game too. I get it. But first, let's talk about the lifestyle issues, because that's what really matters. And that's, to us, is a health hack.
Sleep is probably the most underrated of all tools when it comes to health and wellness.
Absolutely.
Last question for you, Keith, and it's a simple question. It's a question that I honestly could have started this conversation out with, but sometimes I like to end with the obvious questions as well. What does paleo mean to you?
Paleo, to me, means being the captain of your own health. Ultimately, that's it. So I don't outsource my health to a doctor. I work in partnership with a doctor. I don't outsource my health to the government. I have insurance because I'm required to have insurance. And that's it. I am solely responsible for my own health. And I think at the end of the day, that's what paleo is. Now, I don't live on an island because part of paleo is tribe. And we all realize how important tribe is. But if Trey, if you're responsible for your own health and I'm responsible for my own health and Craig's is responsible for his own health, and if he happens to come upon hardship, we can help him out. But at the end of the day, he realizes that this body that he's in right now is the only body he's going to get in this spin around the earth. And I don't know what your spiritual leanings are, but you know, you're not going to come back in this body anyway. So when we get back to the idea that, you know, the body is the temple, I truly believe that.
Keith Norris, co-founder of PaleoFX, thank you so much for this conversation today. I really enjoyed it, and best of luck with PaleoFX 2019 and beyond.
Right on, Trey. Thank you very much for having me.